The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Anne Perkins.
This week, Ireland goes to the polls, and it looks like the ruling party Fianna Fáil that oversaw the biggest crash in the country's history is itself about to crash out. We'll hear from our Ireland correspondent and the man who would be Taoiseach, Fine Gael's Enda Kenny.
Also this week, you can prove anything with statistics, but what do opinion polls tell us? And if there aren't enough hours in the day, should the government legislate to make the evenings longer?
Joining us for all of this, we have in the studio our old friend and Guardian columnist Martin Kettle, and alongside him, the president of YouGov and polling supremo, Peter Kellner.
And on the line from Dublin, we have our Ireland correspondent, Henry MacDonald. Welcome to you all. And Henry, perhaps we could start by discussing the Irish elections and what's likely to be the result after polling day tomorrow. It looks like it's going to be all change. Is that still the mood?
Undoubtedly, the headlines are really in this election that Enda Kenny, the leader of the Fine Gael party, will definitely be Taoiseach or Prime Minister. That the Fianna Fáil party, that has been the dominant force in Irish political life since the 1930s, is going to have an historically disastrous election. There's even a chance of them falling into fourth place, although I think that's unlikely. But nonetheless, their numbers of deputies is going to be severely reduced, more than halved, I would imagine. And the real final question to be decided at this stage is, will Enda Kenny try to go it alone? Will he get enough votes to perhaps rely on independence? Or will he, in the end, have to do what Fine Gael have always done historically since the Second World War, and that is to go into coalition with the Irish Labour Party?
Martin, could you just explain for the uninitiated what these parties are? Henry's talking about Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. Are they left-wing, right-wing? What sort of outfits are they?
Well, Irish political parties, and Henry will correct me where I get this wrong, Irish political parties are not like the political parties of most other Western European countries, because they are formed still and framed by the nationalist struggle against the British at the start of the 20th century. So in this election, you've got a Labour Party, and that's kind of recognisable to the British listener and reader. But you've also got Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, all of which, in various ways, are parties whose origins are in the Republican struggle of the years 1916 and a bit before, and through to the Civil War in 1921 and the Treaty. So all of that sort of hangs over it. Basically, nowadays, Sinn Féin is a party that's well to the left of the Labour Party, and both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are a little bit to the right.
Can I just come in there?
Yes, of course.
I don't think Sinn Féin are that left-wing as people make out. For instance, in Northern Ireland, where they're governing in a coalition with the Unionists, Sinn Féin has embraced privatisation, public-private partnerships. It supports the retention of Ireland's historically low corporation tax, which the Labour Party and others in the past have opposed, although there's question marks over whether they would challenge it this time if they're in government. You know, I think Sinn Féin are rhetorically to the left of Labour, but, you know, and the record in government in Belfast has been, you know, very much centrist. So,
just because you've got guns, it doesn't mean you're not going to sell out when you get in power.
Well, I mean, every single political party in the Republic has had guns at one stage or other, apart from Labour. And even that, they could be argued they did, since they came from the Connollyite tradition. But they all go to the centre ground in the end. And Martin's absolutely right, that there's no real left-right division in relation to, say, modern European politics.
But don't we need one, Henry, at the moment? There's this huge discussion going on about, you know, the future of the economy and, like, the banks and what went wrong and the role of business and yes, unions on the street. Don't we need something more like conventional politics?
Yes, I mean, you do get, there are left-wing parties emerging, like the United Left Alliance from the Irish Trotskyist position tradition, which is doing very well, and will get TDs elected to the Dáil, but I mean, I don't think they'll get any more than four seats. Look, the reality is, I think, that the three main parties are going to accept the International Monetary Fund, European Central Bank conditions for Ireland paying back all that money that was loaned to them. With the Labour Party, it's a matter of just tinkering with the deal. You know, the Labour, for instance, say Ireland can't pay back its debt or drive its debt down to 3% of GDP until 2016. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil say, well, no, that's not possible. The Europeans won't tolerate it. They want it down by 2014. The differences are really not that large between the parties. It's just people blame Fianna Fáil for wasting the years of wealth, of failing to regulate the banking industry, of turning a blind eye to their friends in the property business, in the building trade, the property tycoons who borrowed all this money recklessly and wrecked the Irish banking system.
Peter Kellner, it sounds like the mould's overdue for breaking. Is it going to be broken?
Well, this is what I'm wondering. I'm looking at the latest poll figures, and all the pollsters in Ireland are pretty well agreed that Fine Gael will be nudging 40%, 38-40%. No other party is likely to get 20%. You've got Labour and Fianna Fáil both in the sort of 16-18% area, Sinn Féin around 10 or 11%. Now, you know, on Saturday morning, those sad members of the political number-crunching community who will be watching the RTE results programme on BBC Parliament, we'll be looking at this wonderful system of counting under the single transferable vote.
So the Liberal Democrats' dream system, yeah, isn't it?
These heroes of the Irish political process, the tally men, who will be looking at the votes as they pour out of the boxes and predicting who's actually going to win the fourth and fifth preferences in Dublin South and so on. But what I'm wondering is this. We're not expecting Fine Gael to get an overall majority because it's a proportional system. In Britain, if you had one party, Labour or Conservative, on around 40%, and then Labour and the Liberal Democrats, both or the other two parties, struggling to get 20, you would have a landslide. Mm. You would have a government with a decisive mandate to do whatever needed to be done if it was an economic disaster. So my question, Henry, to you is this. Is there any sense in Ireland that the system is wrong? Do you look enviously at the British system with decisive results? Or do you rather smugly say, actually, we in Ireland are far superior, we have a better system more suited to our country?
Well, the political class, for example, the leader of Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin, has suggested that there has to be some tinkering with the system, the single transferable vote. And what he has suggested, to have a system, I think, which they used to have in Israel, which was you have party lists. And the reason for this is there is a phenomenon in Irish politics called parochialism. This is why we're going to get a lot of independents elected, where people are elected not on national issues, but on, you know, the potholes in the roads in County Cavan or the hospital that hasn't been built in County Wicklow. And in the past, governments have been in hock to these kind of local candidates holding the state to ransom, holding the cabinet to ransom on very, very localised issues. So there is some talk about reforming the system where a certain percentage of the candidates won't be, you know, the local man from down the road. It'll be a national party figure on the list.
And Henry, if you had to bet your mortgage on it, would you say over the next 10 years anything will actually happen? Will talk turn to action?
See, I'm sceptical of that talk of reform. You've raised a very good point here. The Irish love localism. I mean, you know, the cliche from Tip O'Neill that all politics is local. In Ireland, it's very local. I mean, essentially what you have here, to a certain extent, is 43 by-elections tomorrow, okay, in the constituencies. And there will be independents elected, probably a record number, who are getting elected on very localised issues, you know, ranging from, in the past, from fishing licences to potholes in the road. So, but that is why I think, ultimately, when the dust settles, I think we still will get a Fine Gael Labour coalition, because I don't think Fine Gael and the Kenny will get the magic number. The magic number is 83 seats to get an overall majority. They won't get there. They'll get maybe 75 at the best. And they're going to need, I mean, are they going to need 10, 13 independents? Well, I think that's dubious, because some of those independents are centre-left or even left-wing. Some of them are right-wing. Their best bet ultimately will be the Labour Party. And the most significant intervention that I think happened during this last rather dull week of campaigning was Dr. Gareth Fitzgerald, the former Taoiseach, very respected political commentator, former leader of Fine Gael. He said in the University of Limerick at the top of the week, the best option for the country and for stable government is Fine Gael Labour. And I think that intervention was significant.
The problem for Ireland at the moment is everybody knows what they're angry about, but it seems to me from here that there is much less agreement and conviction behind what should be put in its place. And because, as Henry said earlier, all the main parties do in the end agree to the EU bailout and, broadly speaking, to the terms on which...
Through gritted teeth.
Through very, not just gritted teeth, but through very angry protest. Nevertheless, I think the mood is that there is no real alternative. Mm. I mean, you could see that earlier in the campaign and at the end of last year when Labour was running really very strongly in the polls, and there was even some prospect of Labour finishing as the largest single party. That's not going to happen now, or at least that's what the polls are telling us. But it's almost as though as polling day has got closer, people's kind of alternatives have narrowed, really, to and it's really a question of dishing Fianna Fáil, it seems to me, and going for the kind of coalition which Ireland has had in the past, though this one would be a politically strong, electorally stronger one than the ones that there have been in the past. And then the question is, going forward, once the coalition owns the economic difficulties of Ireland instead of Fianna Fáil, how long before the reaction against that sets in? And what will be the dynamic 3-4 years from now in Ireland? Will Fianna Fáil simply bounce back, because it's not in power? Will some other party, some other configuration grow? Where will Labour be in this coalition? There are some really important issues that are going to play out over the next 2 or 3 years. And there's analogies with here.
And in other countries. I remember, 15, 16 years ago, the Conservatives were in power in Canada, fought an election, were reduced to 2 seats. They were effectively wiped out, and people, forests were felled, filling newsprint on other Conservatives dead. They're now back in government in Canada. They spent, 8 or 10 years in the wilderness. There's a lot of ruin in an old party, and I suspect there's a lot of ruin in Fianna Fáil. I think it's more likely they'll bounce back in some form than disappear.
That's right.
But can I just try on one thing? Henry, Martin's saying, this is going to be more about changing the faces maybe than changing the policies.
Yes.
If Fianna Fáil, you said before, is held together more as a sort of social network almost than an ideologically coherent thing,
it's
like
a movement,
maybe a Conservative Party, isn't the glue that holds that coalition together the fact that they've always been in power or close to it? And so couldn't it really be buried this week?
I think it's the Mark Twain cliche again. Reports of their death will be grossly exaggerated. Fianna Fáil are going to take an absolute historic hammering. That is for sure. But look, I've been speaking to their backroom people quite a lot in this election, and the strategy they're going to deploy post this hammering will be to declare a political ceasefire with a new government. I think what you're going to get is probably lots of sound bites about it's our patriotic duty to support any government that's trying to restore the nation's finances, that's trying to rebuild Ireland's reputation abroad. We will do the patriotic thing, and we will not oppose Enda Kenny if he carries on the basic sort of model that we were pursuing in terms of austerity, that kind of thing. So I think they'll try to sort of paint themselves as, beyond partisan politics. This is far too important. This is then in the national interest. That'll be their core strategy for the next 2 to 3 years.
And that comes naturally, doesn't it, to Fianna Fáil?
It does.
Because it is a Republican tradition. And
the
there
party
is that,
of the nation.
Absolutely.
Yes. The party of Éamon de Valera, put nation before party, all that kind of thing. They'll play that up massively. I think the problem is that this coalition, if it's formed, Enda Kenny may still be tempted to try and rule with the independents, but if he goes with Labour, it will have the biggest majority ever in the history of the state, 30+. Now, that can be both a blessing and a curse. As Jack Lynch found, in 1977, Lynch got in the last single-party government. He had a majority of plus 20. But, of course, within about 2 or 3 years, his backbenchers were getting rowdy and rebellious, and Charles J. Hockey was stirring them up. And eventually they launched a coup d'etat against Lynch and got rid of him within only about less than 3 years after his greatest electoral triumph. So, big majorities can cause problems for parties. Backbenchers on the Labour side, on the left wing, will start getting restless, looking over their shoulder at the ULA, the United Left Alliance, and Sinn Féin. You might get a few rebellions here and there, but, the best strategy for the coalition is to hold their nerve and try to see out a full term and see if it all hinges on the economy. If Ireland can recover, if they get the glory for restoring the nation's finances and its reputation,
That certainly sounds familiar.
They might get rewarded with a second term.
Now, Henry has been out on the campaign trail talking to the man who's likely to be taking up the reins after tomorrow's election, Enda Kenny. I think you asked him, didn't you, Henry, how he thought it felt to be this close to power?
Well, I've been round this course before a few times. It's an anxious period for all candidates in the election. But our party's been attracting huge support for the clarity of our plan and I think for the competency of the team that we have to implement it. Irish people are suffering at the moment and they're looking for a way out with a sense of security and strong leadership. And that's what Fine Gael actually offer.
No sense of nerves running? You're not daunted by the prospect of taking on such a huge problem that the country is at the minute?
When you're in politics, you never be nervous about the championship because that's what you look forward to, that's what your life is about. Politicians are there to make two things. One, find solutions, and two, make decisions. We've got the solutions in our plan. We'd like to have the affirmation of the people to be able to make the decisions.
Well, you can follow the ascent of Enda and hear a special documentary podcast on Ireland elections with Henry McDonald at guardian.co.uk Ireland. Now, although it may be polling day tomorrow in the Republic, here we've got 4 years to wait. Nonetheless, newspapers breathlessly publish the latest polls. If there's an election tomorrow, Peter Kellner's latest YouGov poll for The Sun tells us, Labour would be back in business and the Liberal Democrats would be crushed. But there isn't an election, Peter. Do you think people should care?
Should they care about politics? Yes.
Should about
they,
polling?
Should they care about polls? Well, I hope so, because
declare
otherwise
we're
out of business. although, like most, like all market research companies, of course, the great majority of our income comes from, commercial private market research. Look, politics takes place at a number of levels, but one of the levels is the debate between the public and the elite, and we pollsters are trying to inform that debate. So even if there's not an election tomorrow, it is, I think, worth listening to what the public are saying. And it's because of polls, principally, that we know that the Liberal Democrats have taken a hammering since the election, and the Conservatives haven't taken a hammering. And, you know that politicians think that's about right, because those polls feed back into the dynamics of what goes on at Westminster. So, even if there isn't going to be a general election for 4 years, polls do affect the dynamics of politics.
That's what I wanted to ask Martin about, actually, how these polling figures are kind of playing in Downing Street and in the Leader of the Opposition's office.
Well, I think for Downing Street's point of view, I mean, they play really perfectly. Clearly, the Conservative Party is, from top to bottom, increasingly, if cautiously in some parts, confident that the dynamics of electoral opinion in Britain are moving in their way.
Even though they're behind.
The prospect of a single-party Tory government after the next election, I think, is quite alluring. And I think that's partly why you've got so much backbench activity. Because, I mean, of course, there are plenty of people on the right in the backbenches in the Tory party who basically think that the Tories should be governing as though they were a majority and haven't quite got it, that we're in a different playing under different rules now. But I think Tories are fairly confident. But clearly, I mean, the polls are good for Labour in the short term. But how strong that is, whether it's more than a protest move, whether it's a real kind of resettlement of the Labour hegemony that we saw 10, 15 years ago. I think it's much too early to say on that. Yeah, and I suspect Peter would agree, because he's written some very important things on this.
Yes, it's about Miliband really just not doing as well as he perhaps should be, particularly personally.
That's right. I mean, I think two things have been going on substantially. The first is there is a growing anti-government mood. If you look at approval of the government, if you look at the questions we ask about his economic performance and so on, there has been a steady, remorseless decline in government figures, Cameron's own rating and so on. There has not been a commensurate increase in approval of the Labour Party or approval of Ed Miliband since he became leader, 5 months ago. So at the moment, this is principally an anti-government mood. But secondly, you've had the wholesale shift of that part of the Liberal Democratic vote last May, which was essentially anti-conservative, to the Labour Party.
And that's sort of free money, isn't it? I mean,
that's right. And my suspicion is that the Liberal Democrats are not going to be a much better place in 4 years' time than they are now. It's a crazy thing perhaps to say 4 years out, because a huge amount can happen. But if you look at, you know, what happened to the Liberal Democratic vote, three kinds of people, broadly speaking, voted Lib Dem last May. Firstly, people who wanted a fresher, a more honest kind of politics, who didn't like the two main parties, didn't like conventional politics. Secondly, anti-conservatives, who in the places where people live, they decided it's better to vote Lib Dem here than to vote Labour. And thirdly, people who actually believe in liberal democracy in terms of the Lib Dem manifesto. They've lost the first two groups, they've only got the third left. And what I can't see them winning back the first two. In the past, the Lib Dems have often done poorly in midterms, in opinion polls, and then regained this sort of anti-political, anti-Tory protest vote as the election approach. I can't see them getting that back. So, you know, if I were Nick Clegg, and I would not say this, if I were Nick Clegg, I would keep this deeply private, but I would regard my time as Deputy Prime Minister as a fixed term, a five-year appointment, and ponder life outside British politics after 2015. Because I think the Lib Dems, isn't there a flower at Kew Gardens that lives for, you know, 200 or 300 years, doesn't flower, flowers, gives off a big smell and then dies? and I think the Lib Dems are sort of in that position. The price of their 5 years.
That's a treacherous misrepresentation Liberals' history.
I don't buy that. I mean, it's a very beguiling image, but I think it's a red herring.
You know,
obviously what Peter says is a possibility. I mean, and perhaps more than a possibility. It's quite a serious one, and I think, you know, that may be what happens. However, you know, having followed the Liberal Democrats over many, many years, as we all have round this table, what strikes me more and more is what a solid party it actually is. And I think, the idea that that the Liberal Democrats are just going to be wiped off the map or reduced to a few outlying seats in the Hebrides and the Highlands, is really quite unhistorical. I mean, the Liberal Democrats have gradually moved forward. They've slipped back sometimes, but they have become more than just the sort of little add-on to the two main parties in British politics over quite a long period. And whilst I think that looking ahead, they're quite likely to do worse in the next election than they are in this one, I would say that their powers of survival are a bit greater than Peter's suggesting. And I think that there are reasons in local government and other way, aspects of British politics why that should be so. Of course, a lot depends on the Labour Party.
One thing that matters a great deal to the Lib Dems, both in terms of morale and in terms of how they'll fare in terms of seats for the next elections, obviously the alternative vote, which YouGov's been polling on quite a lot. I want to ask you, Peter, when you're asking people about something like the alternative vote, which most people really don't know what on earth it is, can we trust the polls at all, even though there's a referendum in 10 weeks? This is a relevant question.
Let's unbundle the question. Can you trust the polls? I mean, yes, in the sense, if you look at the question they ask, are they honestly reporting what a representative sample of voters think? Yes. There is an interesting divergence between the YouGov results and the results of most other pollsters, including ICM, who poll for the Guardian.
Now,
which is that what the other pollsters do is ask the referendum question.
Yeah.
Which is has a lot of sense to it. What we at YouGov do is we give a brief description of what the alternative vote is and then say, do you want to move to the alternative vote or stay with first past the post? And the reason we do this is that we found that a huge number of people, probably still a majority of the public, don't understand the alternative vote or aren't sure about what it means. And therefore, when you're asking them a referendum question now, when the referendum campaign hasn't really got underway, I think a lot of people at some subconscious level are responding to the question, do you want to keep the present system or do you want something better? And that's why you get a yes majority. And we mostly get a no majority to our question. What is interesting, some of the other pollsters, Populist and Comrades, in the last couple of weeks, have done more elaborate exercises in which they ask a number of questions about voting systems and then ask the referendum question. And when they do it that way, they get similar results to us. In other words, the more people know about AV, the less they seem to like it.
And if the campaign works, that augurs badly for the...
I think I can claim, Martin may be the only other person who could rival me, to be the longest standing public supporter of AV. I don't see AV as a stepping stone to proportional voting, which I'd hate. I've been arguing in the public for AV for 30 years.
Wow. You're unusual in that.
But I'm pessimistic about the being a yes vote, because what tends to happen in referendums around the world is that when a country is divided on an issue, as a referendum day approaches, the status quo becomes more and more attractive. It happened in Scotland in 1979 over devolution. It happened in Australia a dozen years ago over the monarchy. It happened in Spain in the 1980s over NATO, and so on. One could cite other examples. And I think the same is likely to happen this time. And what we noticed just this week in our latest poll conducted after the big speeches by David Cameron and Nick Clegg last week on the same day, is the Conservative voters have moved quite sharply in the last week or so towards the no camp. And therefore, the Liberals, aren't many of them, they'll vote yes. Tory voters will vote overwhelmingly no. And at the moment, the only way the yes camp can win, in my view, is if there's a really, really strong campaign by Ed Miliband to say to Labour voters, as Labour voters, you should vote yes. And I can't see the kind of strength of campaigning, as distinct from the mere statements that he supports AV, which Ed Miliband has given. I can't see the strength of Labour campaigning that will be decisive enough.
The yes campaign's pinning its hopes on this being a non-political campaign, an anti-political campaign almost. I mean, I wonder if there's a strong enough case to be made that AV will undermine the, you know, the kind of security of tenure which appears to have contributed to the problems.
I mean, I'm deliberately not, as we're getting in, you know, I could argue the highlights of a donkey on the case for AV. I'm trying to look at it as an objective analyst. But on this point, you know, what in a sense the Yes campaign need is what one might call the Joanna Lumley factor. Remember the Gurkha campaign, or was it a year or so ago, or 2 years ago? It wasn't just that this very popular figure supported the Gurkhas, but she was passionate. She was on our screens night after night. And that had a huge impact. Now, what have the Yes camp got? Well, they've got two great stars, Colin Firth and Colin Firth and Helena Bonham Carter, which are two of the great stars to have, since hopefully both will win Oscars this coming weekend. But what they need is not just leaflets saying Colin Firth is on our side. You need Colin Firth and Helena Bonham Carter doing a Joanna Lumley, being out there night after night, passionately arguing, if you like, the anti-political case for AV. And I haven't seen that.
Cheeking government ministers and generally winding up opinion.
Yeah, because the referendum's actually just a week after the royal wedding. I mean, clearly, what you need is for Kate Middleton to come out as pro AV, and you know that's the future for the country. And if Kate Middleton was to
Have the same passion as Peter on this,
who can say?
Well, we're running out of time on the programme, in the way that some people feel they run out of hours in the day. And this Friday, the government's going to publish its tourism strategy, and it could include the proposal that Greenwich Mean Time GMT is abandoned, which would mean that we would have lighter evenings and darker mornings all year round, and possibly even plus two in the summer. So we'd have especially long summer evenings. Now, the Conservative backbencher Rebecca Harris is hoping she's going to be able to build support for this idea with her campaign, as she told politics.co.uk.
What this would do would be to ensure we've moved an hour of daylight, which currently we have in the early morning, towards the end of the day, every day of the year, so when people can actually make the benefit of it, enjoy it. And I only discovered how much free daylight we waste, actually, when I had a baby. And, so the dawn arriving at 5 o'clock in the morning sometimes, and we're all fast asleep. If you move the hour of daylight to the end of the day, when people can benefit from it more, road safety experts are absolutely convinced it will save about 80 lives on our roads a year and many hundreds of more serious accidents, which means it's got to be worth looking at. There's also the tourist industry thinks it could create about 80,000 new jobs. And anything that's going to create 80,000 new jobs is worth looking at the moment. They think it could be worth about $3.5-4.5 billion to UK tourism, because it extends the tourist season and attractions can stay open.
And lower electricity consumption too, I seem to remember. What's not to like, Martin?
Well, I think The Guardian has consistently supported this change, editorially, I should say. It's been one of the most vigorously debated questions around the leader writers' table over the many years that I've sat around that table. So, you know, I think this is a big chance. And, of course, you know, I think it's having just been to Paris last weekend, and we all travel back and forth a lot during the year. I mean, it is so daft that we're not on the same in the same time zone as our near continental neighbours. Obviously, there's some objections in the north of Scotland, and that has prevailed in the past. But I think for most people, it would be quite sensible to move to European time. So we just abolished the GMT thing
I think this is one of the few as were objective advantages, and the Tories having virtually no support in Scotland, because when this came up, it did two or three times when Labour was in government. In the end, it was Labour MPs in Scotland kicking up a stink that persuaded the Labour whips to back off. Well, there aren't any Tory MPs in effect to kick up a stink. Well, but here's my suggestion. Because, you know, some Scots, and I understand it, that it, you know, if it doesn't get light till 10:30 in the morning in the middle of December, if we move on to effectively European time, I can see that causes some worry. Why not legislate for England, perhaps England and Wales, and let the Scots then decide whether to follow us or to stay on a separate time zone, and then the Scottish executive can deal with the issue of the Highlands. I don't think the Highlands should dictate to the rest of Great Britain.
I mean, I think that's a very good idea. And of course, if it happened, but if Scotland did move with England and Wales onto European time, it would bring us full circle in terms of this discussion, because you'd leave Ireland out in the Atlantic as the one country in Western Europe which remained on British time.
Yeah, and then in Belfast, you know, maybe Gerry Adams and Peter Robinson, or Martin McGuinness and Peter Robinson, can then get together and decide whether to go on to Dublin time or London time.
Well, Martin and Peter, having so expertly brought us full circle, we'll draw a line under things for this week. So thank you, Henry McDonald, Peter Kellner and Martin Kettle. My name is Tom Clark.
And I'm Anne Perkins. And thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.